congratulations to everyone who finished the Lansing Marathon yesterday. It was especially impressive given the wind that was coming out of the west yesterday. I was out pedaling my bike, and I mean, you could have chosen a better day to ride a bike, let alone run a marathon, than yesterday. I'm sure it was a challenge, but congratulations to all the nearly 1,900 participants yesterday in the third Lansing Marathon. Coming up later this hour on Current State, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, a number of school funding votes happen tomorrow in Lansing and around Lansing. We'll visit with Grand Ledge Superintendent Brian Metcalf about a $60 million proposal in Grand Ledge, and with Peter Spadafore, a supporter of renewing a Lansing school district millage. At the top of our program today, late last week, the latest numbers for Michigan were released for the Affordable Care Act's first open enrollment period, which ended on March 31st. Turns out more than 272,000 people signed up for one of the plans available on the healthcare.gov website. Of those 272,000, 29% were from the coveted 18 to 34 age group, and 87% were eligible for financial assistance. With us to assess these numbers and how the Affordable Care Act's first open enrollment period went here in Michigan is Aaron Knott. Aaron's the State Director for Enroll America here in Michigan. Welcome back to Current State, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
How would you assess these numbers?
Hey, at Enroll America, we are thrilled, absolutely thrilled, that over 272,000 Michiganders now have access to quality, affordable health care. We're proud of the work that we did, but we're not stopping. Over the next 6 months, we're continuing to talk to consumers across the state because open enrollment begins next November 15th.
Back in November, did you think you'd hit 272,000?
You know, we had some challenges last fall in October and first part of November with the website, but those glitches were fixed and consumers were hungry. They were hungry for the information about the marketplace. They were hungry to know where to go to find in-person assistance, and they really wanted to know more information about the financial assistance. And like you said, 87% of Michiganders that signed up for health insurance received financial assistance to help them pay for their premiums.
So 272,000, how many people could have signed up? Is that known?
Well, you know, we were working with just over 1.1 million Michiganders that did not have insurance. Now, some of those folks will qualify for our new Medicaid expansion program, or Healthy Michigan, and some of those folks, you know, went directly through the marketplace, and others, they elected to just work one-on-one with an insurance provider. But again, you know, over the next 6 months, for those people that haven't taken the opportunity to take a look at their options, it's our staff and volunteers' job to find them, to talk to them, and make sure that they don't miss out come the next open enrollment period.
I know getting sufficient numbers of young people was a pretty big concern for a while. How do you feel about 29% of enrollees coming from the 18 to 34 demographic?
You know, we're elated by that number because, again, you know, those young adults, we know that they want health insurance. It's just not been something that, you know, they've thought about. You know, they went from their parents' plans, perhaps, to now being on their own, and they just needed, you know, to know where to go to look for it. And in the end, we saw a spike and young adults that were calling us, they were asking us where they could get assistance. And, you know, we know that more than half of them were able to get plans at under $50 per month.
We did hear reports. I mean, I think we all heard reports that there was concern that enough 18 to 34s would sign up. 29% seems like a very good number. Do you know how Michigan, how did that 29% compare to other states? Do you know?
I don't know, Mark. I haven't analyzed the numbers in that detail because, again, I'm laser focused on working with consumers here in Michigan and making sure that nobody misses out on the opportunity to, you know, receive health insurance. So right now we're working on educating folks about what's happening next November, as well as making sure that people are aware that if their circumstances change, they lose a job, they move, they get a divorce, that they qualify for that special enrollment period. Where they can contact the Department of Health and Human Services, go back to the marketplace and make a correction, you know, with their personal situation.
There were well-publicized problems with the website, healthcare.gov, back in the fall. How did the website perform as it got closer to the deadline?
you know, in the end, the website was just like doing any kind of online shopping, whether you're going to Amazon and making, you know, a book purchase. We were getting report backs from not only consumers, but from our partners across the state that if somebody already had an account, they had an email address, they were ready to go on and shop, that you could get in and out in 20 to 30 minutes. And that was the ultimate goal, was to make it a seamless process whereby you went online, you looked at the information, you selected your plan, and then you exited out.
Our guest on Current State, Aaron Knott, State Director for Enroll America in Michigan. We're talking about the end of the first open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, which Aaron and her organization were heavily involved in. Overall, what were some of the bigger misunderstandings misconceptions that you encountered?
You know, the biggest by far was the lack of information, and we were hearing this across the state from consumers about the financial assistance. It just seemed too good to be true that they were going to be able to receive help to purchase health insurance, and that's still a barrier. And again, our job right now is to make sure that those folks that didn't take part in this historic moment that ended last, you know, March 31st, that they know where to go for assistance. They know that they do qualify for financial assistance. And again, our job is just to help them between now and November 15th.
What were some of the best practices that you developed, Aaron?
We know that oftentimes consumers, particularly African Americans and Latinos, they needed multiple touches to repeated engagement to go to the marketplace to take a look at what was going on. We also know that those consumers did better when they sat down with an in-person assister. By and large, African Americans and Latinos were 43% more likely to seek in-person help than their white counterparts, and that's a national number right there.
And by touches, you mean repeated
contacts,
outreach.
Yeah, you know, whether we were talking to them on the doors, or you know, out in their community at the grocery store, a barber shop, in their churches. Again, we know that there were certain consumers that just they really needed to be told about the information repeatedly. They really needed to be told about what it meant, what you needed to have to qualify for financial assistance. And then again, here's somebody that's located just down the street from you that's certified by the federal government that's able to help you, you know, walk through that process in more detail.
What, if anything, Aaron, didn't work at first that maybe you altered your approach on throughout the course of the period?
Well, you know, towards the end of the open enrollment session, we found by and large that larger scale enrollment events were very, very successful for us. And so we were working with partners, we were sponsoring events, you know, with churches or with Access located in Dearborn or other kind of navigator or assistance services across the state. And we were having, you know, these events where 100 to 200 people were coming out. They were learning about their options. They were then meeting up with an assister right then and there on the spot and working on their enrollment application. And so again, that was one of our best practices that we weren't doing early on, but in the end there, we were having these events across the state almost, you know, 2-3 times a week.
How many volunteers did you use in this first enrollment period?
Man, we couldn't have made this happen without the help, the dedication of the over 3,400 volunteers that not only, you know, worked with us once or twice, but repeatedly were coming back. They were signing up to take shifts on doors, you know, in neighborhoods. They were helping us table at events. And those large enrollment events that I was just referencing, you know, they were there, they were signing people in, they were passing out information and linking people to that in-person assistance. You know, we couldn't have done it without our, you know, the 3,400 volunteers and counting. They were instrumental to our success.
Will you scale back that number, though, now?
After the first
enrollment period is done, is there any reason to cut that number back?
Not at all. Right now, we are debriefing and celebrating with our volunteers across the state. We have a series of, you know, events where, again, we're celebrating, we're talking about what worked, what didn't work, and then we're engaging them in our planning process for the summer and fall months. So we don't, you know, yeah, there will be some drop-off as people's plans change, but we're recruiting more volunteers, and we want to keep everybody that's worked with us to date involved in the campaign and to have a real buy-in in what we're going to do and how we're going to do it over the summer and fall months.
There will be another open enrollment period later this year. Let's focus on that. When does that start?
Open enrollment begins November 15th and runs through February of 2015. So, you know, we have a few months to plan, to prep, and then we're going to be back in communities knocking on doors probably towards the end of June. So we're not going away anytime soon.
And you alluded to a special enrollment period as well. Who qualifies for the special enrollment period?
Anyone qualifies for that special enrollment period if you have a life-changing circumstance. So as an example, there's a birth in your family, there's a divorce or a marriage, if you move, if your income changes, there's a list of these life-changing circumstances. And if something like that happens to you, you have 60 days to contact the marketplace to report that change. And so we're, encouraging and educating all consumers that, sometimes things happen, planned or unplanned, and you have the option, the right to go to the marketplace to report it and to have your insurance change.
And is your organization playing a particular role in the special enrollment period, or is most of your attention on the next open enrollment period?
We're doing both. Again,
okay.
As we encounter consumers that, are telling us, oh, this just happened to me, is there an option for me? We're making sure that they have the information. But again, right now we're back in communities, we're planning, we're talking to our volunteers, and we're actively, aiming towards finding those folks that didn't participate this time around.
And Aaron, what sort of involvement have you had with the Healthy Michigan Plan?
Sure. We're the same kind of navigators and in-person assisters that we worked with regarding the marketplace. They're now changing their program work over, and they're helping with Healthy Michigan. So again, if consumers are talking to us about, they qualify for Healthy Michigan, where do they go to sit down with somebody, or where do they go for more information? We're providing that information for them.
What's your sense as to how it's working so far?
Well, it seems like last week the numbers came out that we were at, just under 200,000 new enrollees in Healthy Michigan. I think that's a huge success, and we should be celebrating that.
Aaron Knott is the State Director for Enroll America here in Michigan. Aaron, thanks for joining us on Current State.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. The process of moving to another country for studies is daunting. There's paperwork to be filed, cultural adjustments, and lots of questions. At Michigan State University, the Office for International Students and Scholars, or OISS, helps international students navigate school here in the U.S. For over a decade, Peter Briggs has served as the director of OISS. Under his leadership, MSU's international reputation has continued to grow, drawing students from around the world. Briggs is retiring this fall. He joins us now to reflect on his work and the role international students play at universities. Peter, welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
We talked a little bit about what OISS does there. Tell us a little bit more. Go deeper with us. What kinds of services do you provide? What kinds of programs do you have?
Well, first of all, who we work with are legally guests in the country, so they need papers to get a visa to come to the country to study, to teach, do research, whatever it is that they're coming here to do. And so we are the designated office on campus that knows all the bureaucratic parts of getting somebody from another country here. And then once they're here, they are humans. They have challenges to face what are all the services that we provide? How can we help them achieve their academic goals? And then who takes care of them if there's an emergency? If there's an earthquake in another country and they've lost family members, or if there's something that happens here, who is their parent in the absence of their parent? And we play all these roles. We are in contact with foreign embassies and consulates when there is an emergency. So we play a wide-ranging role of role on campus to help make this whole enterprise successful.
I know visa challenges, they can be challenging. How often, what percentage of the time do you run into a really thorny visa issue?
Well, it's a daily issue on our campus, and I think I can say that it's changed in the years that I've been here at MSU, where our current environment has 4,400 students from China in the first years that I was here. It was very, very hard to get a student visa out of China. So it has changed over the years. And, you know, U.S. government has a difficult job, too, to keep our border safe. And we're trying to be good partners with them, but at the same time being welcoming here. So the visa bureaucratic part, to get into the weeds of it, yeah, it's a headache.
How did you wind up in this field?
I started out as a part-time ESL teacher at Seattle University in 1974. And I just found it amazing what I didn't know about the rest of the world. And with that, I became very enthusiastic about knowing people from other countries, and then one thing led to another, and I've been advising international students and scholars for close to 40 years now.
How have international students changed during your tenure?
I think it's been interesting to watch the different waves. When I was first in this field, the largest group was from Iran. There were 55,000 Iranian students in the United States in the late 70s. Of course, the world circumstances, the relations with Iran changed. Late in the 80s became a wave of Japanese students. Now there's a big wave of Chinese students. So it's been interesting to watch these, how the world situation, whether it's wealth or the need for education or the capacity, has evolved or changed or shifted over the years. It will shift again, I'm sure.
I did some reporting on a group of Libyan students who were in East Lansing a couple of years ago when Muammar Gaddafi was removed from power. And there was, that led to a very challenging situation for Libyan students here at Michigan State University. And a lot of those had to do with visa issues as well.
Well, they were all sponsored students, yeah. And that was really one of the more challenging things because at the time the government abandoned their sponsored students. And so these students, there were 36 of them, they were all without funding. How long could we fund them? How long could we get them through what they were going to be here to do? And the community, it shows what a special community East Lansing was in terms of how were we in that process of transitioning them to our community. And we had a really good plan. Eventually it worked out where these students, the government did fall eventually. The students were transferred to a school in Washington, D.C. But certainly they were abandoned by their country. And we have not had that kind of circumstance very often.
Your job sounds like an ongoing education in world politics, really, to quite an extent.
Well, I'm a generalist. And I think the people that work in my office, we work for students from 130 countries every day. And there are other people on campus who specialize in Japanese culture or Russian culture, Chinese culture. And we see the whole world scene play out every day, and it is absolutely on the ground fascinating.
MSU has a reputation around the country, but it's also acquired a reputation abroad. What is that reputation?
East Lansing, Michigan is a very good place for an international student to be. It's affordable, it's safe, it's caring. And I think of some of the community people who have been involved, and let me give a shout out to Community Volunteers for International Programs, started 50 years ago as a faculty wives club mending coats for African students. And now they put on the annual Global Festival. They put on a number of different home hospitality programs. And they are emblematic of the caring nature of this community and the leadership that we've had here. And I think that word of mouth spreads about what a caring place this is. And it's been a privilege to sustain that for years.
Talk to us about how international students benefit the university, impact the university in general.
Well, the opportunities are endless. I mean, certainly the academic talent is in certain departments that we have. We really need their talent in the sciences and the art and other areas. But it really transforms us. And friendship with an international student can be transformational. And as you learn something or you have a roommate or a classmate from another country and they say something or you can feel a certain empathy, and how do we, any of us, get a global perspective? And I think relationships and friendships with people from abroad who are right here in our community, you don't need to leave town to have an international experience. And that's what's the biggest benefit of all. But there are certainly many, but everybody can be a citizen diplomat in their own way, on campus and off campus.
Our guest today on Current State, Peter Briggs. Peter's the outgoing director of the OISS, the Office for International Students and Scholars here at Michigan State University. How do you think universities in general could improve the experience of international students, and how do you focus on that?
That's a great question. Certainly the people from abroad who enter our classrooms have come to from another educational system. So many of these systems emphasize memorization. In the first year experience here, we're trying to get them to analyze, and we've got faculty who want to engage them in debate with students who really have never, they're maybe not even confident with their English, but they're also not experienced in talking with a faculty member to have a debate and have a dialogue. And so how do we prepare the faculty for a new kind of student who's here, and how do we prepare the students for being more proactive in the classroom, because that we want them to take control of their own learning in that way. So there's a lot of mutual learning that needs to take place in a globally friendly campus. I think we need to be always sympathetic with the struggles that these students are having, and not just say, well, you just do it this way in this country. It's just not going to be easy to abandon your lifetime of experience in another place.
Do you think that the growth of international students attending American universities will continue to grow?
Yeah, statistics from OECD will say that there's about 4 million people right now studying outside their home countries, and the United States has about 22% of the world's market share of students abroad, and they say that number is probably going to triple in the next 15 years. So I think this is a growth industry. And I think MSU has had a long legacy of leadership in
Why triple? That is a dramatic increase.
Because half the world's population is under the age of 20. And the need for education worldwide is going to only grow. And if you don't get education when you're young, you're stuck outside the economic mainstream and other kinds of opportunities. And so now there's all these different hubs that want to be hosting international students. Singapore wants to be the hub of education in that region. China wants to be the hub of education. South Africa wants to be the hub of education for the continent. It's fascinating to watch this global competition for brain power playing out.
Is there a chapter of your career here, a period of your career here at Michigan State that's particularly memorable for you?
I've enjoyed the entire experience here. This is a wonderful university to be an international educator, because the arguments, the assumptions about people from abroad being here needing special support, they were already all in place. We don't have to make those arguments. So I frankly arrived at a peculiar time, because I interviewed for the job in July of 2001, and then September 11th happened and I started in October. So immediately, I was responsible for administering all the Homeland Security regulations that went into effect after 9/11. And I was new here and still learning the way. So our profession changed from being one of adjusting and helping people from other societies get acclimated here to a compliance function, in which we now report to the Department of Homeland Security, and we have a new relationship with the U.S. government that is different than it was before. So that gets back to the beginnings of when I was here, but each role, this is the new normal now. And so we've gotten it. And what's been wonderful, I think, about MSU and East Lansing is we've still maintained our welcoming heritage. And that didn't change with the new compliance regulations. And I'm quite proud of that.
We've seen a dramatic increase in the number of Chinese students at MSU. What are Chinese students in particular most in need of?
Well, they're challenged. One of the challenges is their numbers alone make it so easy for them to stay within their Chinese group, and helping them have a richer U.S. experience where they can not only learn English better and understand our culture better, but they come with them with a lifetime of the Chinese educational system, in which they don't as much participate in classroom activities. They are waiting to be, you know, taught by a smart professor. And so helping them adjust to that educational systems transition is certainly one of the bigger classroom transitions I think we need to work on. But just for us to be welcoming, this is they now have a big community, and I think we need to think more broadly about how to engage them, because the U.S.-China relationship is the most important in the world in the next 100 years. And we want to have that. We have an amazing opportunity in 2014 to make them have memories that will last with them a lifetime and be friends forever.
Is there how many more Chinese students are coming to East Lansing in the fall? Do you know that?
We can predict that we'll be similar to the fall of 2013. We had about 1,000 Chinese freshmen fall of 13, and our prediction now is we will have a similar number in fall of 14.
What are your next steps?
Well, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and my family's out there. My wife's family's out there. My kids are all out there. So we're returning to the Pacific Northwest, but I'm on the boards of a couple different nonprofit organizations, and I intend to be involved with them. And I'd like to do more writing. I've always wanted to do more writing, and I have some good ideas, but I've never really found the time to do it.
It's about what?
How do we shift theory to practice in international exchanges? How do exchanges work? What's the real benefit? Because I think international education is something that is unique and transformational in the best way, but it still is more marginal than mainstream, and we need to figure out ways to really learn from each other, learn from diversity. And I think that's a really important, it needs to be structured into the educational system a little bit more deeply than it is currently taking place.
Peter Briggs has served as director of the OISS here at Michigan State since October 2001. He's retiring this year. Peter, best of luck, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for your time, please.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Voters will make important school funding decisions tomorrow in Lansing and a number of other mid-Michigan districts. Those include Grand Ledge, Eaton Rapids, Williamston, and others. In the capital city, taxpayers are being asked to renew a non-homestead millage that's expiring. In just a few minutes, we'll discuss the measure with a supporter, Lansing School Board President Peter Spadafor. In Grand Ledge, voters will decide on a proposal for a $60 million bond that would fund safety and security improvements, technology, transportation, and other renovations. The 1.95 mills would add $83 a year to the tax bill of the owner of a home valued at $100,000. Proponents, including our next guest, say approval of the bond means Grand Ledge would still have the lowest millage rate in the area. Let's learn more with Grand Ledge School Superintendent Brian Metcalf. Brian, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to be here.
In your mind, is there an urgency to getting this additional revenue?
You know, I think it is a very urgent matter. We have a number of issues across the district that we're going to address with this millage. And you know, we talk about safety and security and today's environment. We have multiple levels of safety and security that we're putting in place with this bond. In fact, it's probably one of the greatest expenditures of the bond money. But additionally, we also have money there for technology, as you'd mentioned, and that's probably the second largest piece of the bond, and we're moving towards a one-to-one initiative for our students. And we know if students are going to be career and college ready in the future, we've got to have them ready to use technology, and they have to not only be able to use it in the workplace, but they have to learn with it as well.
Do you consider the safety and security piece, though, the centerpiece of this bond proposal?
You know, it is in a number of ways. First of all, we're going to have new safety devices in each and every classroom. We're going to have safety devices at every building, and including more safety initiatives in each of the offices so that when visitors or or anybody's coming to the building, they are actually going into one of the main offices to be greeted by one of our employees. So yes, it is the probably the number one most important aspect of this bond issue.
Still, almost 80% of the revenue it would raise would go to investments other than safety and security, including a new art center. And comments on social media suggest some number of people won't support it because it includes too many extras. They say things like the safety and security items I'm okay with, but less so for arts and athletics. When you meet someone who feels that way, what do you tell them?
You know, there's a couple of things that I normally address. First of all, the bond is going to touch students in multiple ways. There are some small athletic pieces. There are some small arts pieces in there. And when we look at an overall education, we know it has to be well-rounded because we're trying to get students engaged in all kinds of ways to make them better students. And I think we all know somebody that back in high school or, you know, even a student now that is a great athlete or loves the drama and does the play productions. However, if it wasn't for those athletics or it wasn't for the drama, the student would not be engaged as a student. And that's our number one goal is to get kids to graduate and then move into a vocational or a college setting. So any of the extras that we have in there, that's to support their overall student learning. Very important.
Are you confident the measure will pass?
You know, I hear quite regularly from our citizens, our parents, community members that they are very, very positive about this bond. We have minimalized the athletic pieces. We've minimalized the extra pieces. That's why I said a good deal of it goes straight to the safety, security, and technology. We also have busing improvements, and that's very important. Last year, we had to eliminate some busing due to the decreased general fund from the state of Michigan. We're operating about $5 million less per year now than we did 4 years ago. And so we've reduced some of that busing, but this bond is going to help us to buy new buses and hopefully reinstate some of those stops that we had to cut last year. And the other piece that that we talk about, and it's probably maybe as important or more important than safety security, is some of the operations pieces. We've got some different mechanical units across the district. And I'll give you two examples. One's up at Wacoosta Elementary. We've got 8 rooftop units up there. And this past winter, we had a maintenance person on the roof almost every day, either fixing or restarting one of those rooftop units. And the problem with that is we actually had classrooms that were 52 to 60 degrees multiple times throughout the year. And I've got 6th graders sitting there in their winter coat shivering instead of learning math and writing and doing the educational things we need to do with them.
Great.
Likewise, we've got some similar issues at the high school. We've had classrooms that were 85 degrees this past spring, just a few weeks ago, because of some of the mechanical failures. Mm. The district has to be able to replace those, just like you and I would have to replace a water heater or a furnace if it goes bad in our house. The district needs funds in order to update those mechanical pieces and maintain our classrooms a suitable learning environment.
Brian Metcalf is the superintendent of Grand Ledge Public Schools. Voters in Grand Ledge go to the polls tomorrow to determine the fate of a $60 million bond proposal. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Mark. It's great talking to you.
Lansing voters face a different proposal tomorrow. They're being asked to renew a nearly $18 million non-homestead property tax for 20 years. It would bring in an estimated $18 million into the system next year. To learn more, we welcome back Peter Spadafore, president of the Lansing School Board, who is a supporter of the renewal. Hi, Peter.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me here.
Remind us who is taxed by a non-homestead millage.
Sure. This is folks that own non-homestead property. So that's all taxable property other than your principal residence, which is your home, qualified agricultural property, qualified forestry property, supportive housing property, property occupied by a public school academy, school buildings, and industrial personal property. So it's
does that add up to most forms of property apart from personal residence?
That's correct. It's most forms of property.
Just about everything else. Yes. Is this general operating revenue, or is this revenue that's earmarked to particular areas?
This is general operating revenue. It's basically used to pay teachers and staff, keep the lights on, all those types of things. So it's we've been relying on this money since 1994 when Proposal A passed and changed the way school funding worked, and it really does operate the school district. It's about 11 to 12% of our operating budget.
That averages out to just over $18 million a year. To cut right to the chase, how would having to eliminate $18 million a year from your budget impact the district?
It would be devastating for the district, to say the least. We're talking 170 teaching positions is about what that equates to. We can't cut 170 teachers, so we'd be finding many, many ways. I'm sure we would not see athletics, we would not see buses, you know, all of those types of things to add up to $18 million annually if this millage does not pass.
I know the legislature has yet to determine its support for school districts for next year. Given that, tell us about your proposed spending plan for next year.
Sure. And everything we're doing right now assumes that the voters vote yes tomorrow and pass the operating millage. So we're looking at approximately a $6 million shortfall next year. The superintendent and our budget committee that I put together a few weeks ago have been meeting regularly, and the board met Saturday morning to talk about their suggestions or their first thoughts on the issue. And we think we have some plans, but there are a lot of sort of the sacred cows that have not been talked about in years that are being considered in the very early stages. It was clear from the board and the superintendent that this year we wanted to stay out of the classroom as much as possible. We've had a lot of cuts done that have had to affect the classroom over the last 10 years, and this board is committed to, one, balancing the budget, but two, not balancing out of the back of the students.
Is there a sacred cow you can share with us?
Let's talk about transportation. It's been a difficult issue to deal with, and it's come up in front of the board since I've been there several times. We looked around the table and said we've got to look at all options on this. Might that include the elimination of high school transportation? That's an $800,000 savings right there. That gets us, you know, partway to our $6 million shortfall.
Not farming it out, not making it available to a commercial carrier.
Just this eliminating high school transportation was one thing that was put on the table. Nothing is done yet. We've got a long time until the board has to adopt its final budget at the end of June, but we're putting everything on the table at this point in time.
So a $6 million shortfall, which has to be resolved by the end of this month?
By the end of June.
By the end of June. I beg your pardon.
We have never established a deficit budget, and we will not do that while I'm president.
You will not establish a deficit budget.
That's correct.
Now, this coincides with a discussion over which buildings and facilities the district should use and invest in the future, and which ones to repurpose or sell. Is that related? I assume that may well be related to your $6 million shortfall for next year.
We are not looking at the facilities plan as a way to close our budget deficit because there's not enough building out there to close or sell to really close a deficit, and that's a one-time fix. You know, if I sell an elementary school for $500,000, it's just 1 year. Then I have next year's $500,000 to worry about. So we have to look at operational in terms of the budget. The facilities are being tied into our long-term strategic plan, and we started that process a few weeks ago. May 8th, we are having a special session of the Board of Education to meet with our strategic planning consultant to start talking about our goals. The administration is doing the same thing. And we've also planned, or are in the process of planning, 10 community input sessions throughout the month of May across the district, where the community will have a chance to come in and help shape our priorities for the next 3 to 5 years. Our goal is to begin looking at decisions, how they affect the long-term product in the district, rather than responding to immediate fires, you know, the $6 million deficit. We have to fix that, but what are the goals in fixing that? Where are our priorities, and what do those look like? We haven't had a strategic plan on the books since I was elected, and I think a few years before that. So this is a time where we've got a superintendent who's been here for 2 years now, so we're getting in the stride with working together. She's beginning to shape the administrative team into the team she really thinks can do the job. So we're organizationally ready to start making long-term decisions, and that's what the strategic plan is all about. And that's why we've sort of held off on the facilities discussion, because we want all of those decisions to be based on data and goals rather than the immediate need to close buildings or sell buildings.
What are your priorities as a board member with regard to the strategic plan? Has that started to take shape in your mind?
It started
mind?
To take shape in my head, and everything I do, I kind of look at it. How does it affect student achievement? And we're looking at, in my mind, setting up a district and goals that everything is based on how do students do better? How do we get students prepared for the next step? And, you know, it sounds odd, but a building conversation has a direct impact on student achievement, because we're talking, are we going to have small schools? Are we going to have big schools? Do we need new schools? All of those factors factor in to student achievement. So that's my primary focus, is trying to get the board making decisions primarily on student achievement. And that's not to say that my colleagues don't do that, but sometimes we look at it as a dollar and cents decision, and that might not be the best solution. It's probably the solution in front of us, but we are now hopefully going to start looking long-term, 3 to 5 years, and looking at goals as well. So raising graduation rates by X number of percentage in 5 years, and begin to look at those every year. Are we on track to meet those goals? How do the decisions we make help us meet those goals? That's my goals as a board member. So rather than looking at what's right in front of me, I want the board to look on the horizon when we make decisions.
We're talking with Peter Spadafore, president of the Lansing School Board, here about the upcoming budget and about the non-homestead property tax that will be voted on tomorrow. Generally, Peter, do you feel student performance would be enhanced by keeping open the three buildings that are currently functioning as high schools in Lansing, Sexton, Everett, and Eastern?
We're seeing marginal gains in our test scores, and we're seeing huge gains in our graduation rates. We still have a long way to go, and I'm not sure what we can attribute to that yet, but we did just restructure our K through 12 offerings, so we now have an emphasis on the pre-K through 3 in separate buildings, 4 through 6 in separate buildings, and two of our high schools now operate as 7 through 12. We're starting to see that impact how students do, the attitudes in the buildings, but it's only been a year and a half or two, so it's premature to know if that decision has affected student achievement quite yet.
The district's approaching the end of its first school year, taking a different approach to arts education. How has it gone from your perspective? What are you hearing from the administration on that as well?
Sure. We've heard from a lot of people on that, actually. From the administration, we hear the truth, which is, you know, as with every new endeavor, there was a rocky start, but it seems to be off to they're catching their stride and they're doing well. We've applied for several grants to help supplement that those offerings, and they're one-time grants to try and, you know, develop curriculum and implement that type of thing. So it's only been about a year, a little less than a year. So as of now, I'd say it's going well. We'll reevaluate it at the end of next year and see what the teachers are saying, what the students are saying. But we've had presentations from the Integrated Arts Committee, and they have done a great job at integrating arts, physical education into the curriculum.
And good response from parents, from families?
Most parents I've talked to have, once they understand it and see what the students are doing in school, they think, yeah, this is working. I like the way we're doing this. There's still some misunderstandings, and it's different. People don't like change necessarily. But I think if anyone can do it, it's the staff at the Lansing School District. They've got this really good attitude of how can we work together to make sure that, you know, where my strengths are, I'm working on, and where your strengths are, you're helping me with, and those types of things. And it's been very fun to watch the staff think creatively on how to make this work.
A great discussion, Peter. Many thanks for coming in. Peter Spadafore, president of the Lansing School Board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Neurodegenerative disorders, such as Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's, cost the U.S. billions of dollars each year. Last year, a study supported by the National Institutes of Health found that in 2010, the cost of treating Alzheimer's alone neared $215 billion. These devastating illnesses also take a huge emotional toll on both the victims and their loved ones. A team at Michigan State University is studying a protein molecule that it feels may become a new drug in the fight against degenerative diseases. They say they're ready to make the leap to clinical trials. Current State's Kevin Lavery has the story.
Scientists have been studying Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and Huntington's disease for well over a century. In the last two decades, the cases of such high-profile figures as actor Michael J. Fox and actor-turned-president Ronald Reagan put these disorders into the national spotlight. In that time, researchers have made good strides towards zeroing in on what causes these ailments, and some of that work is happening at Michigan State University.
The first thing we have to ask is, why do we get these diseases? And we think we're starting to uncover that.
Dr. Lisa Lapidus is not an MD. She's a physicist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Her work focuses on how proteins fold, that is, form three-dimensional structures in the body to carry out different tasks.
Proteins are in every cell of your body. They do almost all the work in your body, and they all have the same basic chemical structure.
Proteins are made up of thousands of amino acids that link together in long chains. Many have a corkscrew shape that looks something like rotini pasta noodles or a desktop telephone cord. Remember those? Proteins do all kinds of things, from sending chemical signals to fighting off foreign antibodies. In a healthy body, protein chains bind together to create these Tinker Toy-type designs that carry out the functions of life. But sometimes, Lapita says, they don't, and that's when the problems start. Instead of binding harmoniously, some proteins aggregate, that is, clump together.
What do we know about why rogue protein chains clump together?
Not nearly as much as we think we ought to. What we have discovered in my lab is that there seems to be a correlation between how fast a particular protein can move around to find the shape that would make it fold and its likelihood of aggregating. While it's moving around really fast, like a big wiggly worm, if it comes into contact with another protein, it can't stay in one place long enough to stick to the other one. And so it'll tend to just wiggle away and not stick.
Lapidus wants to know the conditions under which proteins go bump in the night. It is dark inside your body, after all. And to do that, you need to shed a little light on the subject. We're standing in Lapidus's lab, looking at a sort of optical pinball machine. It's a tabletop with about a dozen small black lenses mounted 6 inches above the surface. The device shoots two lasers through each of the lenses, one blue and one green. Actually, the blue light also contains a UV laser, but human eyes can't see it. Still, the colors are intriguing.
So this is sort of like that laser grid you see in the spy movies, but maybe not that exciting?
Well, there's less good music, and you can't see the laser beams as clearly, which, of course, wouldn't make them very good in spy movies.
But indeed, we are spying on a common amino acid called tryptophan. It and a few billion others are inside a small black box. That's where the lasers are focused.
So we shine a little pulse of laser light at it. We get it excited. It then will absorb some light. Eventually, it will decay back to a state which won't absorb that light. And we measure how long we absorb that light for. That time tells us how likely it is that that particular amino acid comes into contact with another amino acid someplace else in the chain.
But the molecule that's got Lapidus excited is something called CLR01. Those who study it call it a molecular tweezer. In a word, CLR01 prevents protein clumping. Stop the clumping, stop the disease. Lapita says the work being done at MSU seeks to answer why this molecule may be a potential drug. She says previous studies with other candidates have started out strong but then missed the mark. But this one is different.
What has happened with a lot of these drugs for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in particular is that it looks like it's working in cells, and then it seems to work in animals, and then you put it into people and it doesn't work at all. And that may be because whatever we're trying to use to measure it in cells and animals isn't really attacking the molecules that really matter. We have now tried to understand what the drug does to the molecules, and by doing that, we hope that we've actually understood what will eventually happen when you put it into humans. And that's why we think that clinical trials are a good idea right now.
That's where Lisa Lapidus, the physicist, hands off the work to her colleagues in the medical field. One of them is Dr. Gal Bitton. He's an associate professor of neurology at UCLA. Bitton says CLR01 has been run through 7 scientific models so far, and none of them have produced any side effects. He says other drug candidates have been tested and even written about in medical literature. But Bitton says even then, no one has really known how or why they work.
In this particular case, we do know the fact that it works for a large number of cases, to me, is quite convincing. The fact that we haven't seen side effects, despite all the predictions, the mechanism is really novel. Therefore, I believe we have a breakthrough.
In the medical world, breakthrough is not a term that's flung around lightly. Still, Bitton says securing the necessary funding to take CLR01 to clinical trials has been tough. He says while his team has received some grants from foundations that support Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and ALS research, they haven't been enough. So Bitton is appealing directly to the public through crowdfunding. He concedes it's an uncomfortable journey for a scientist.
I don't like doing this. I would much rather sit in the lab and design the next experiment or write the next paper than try to do fundraising. But I know that the patients can't wait, and I believe that what we have is going to make a huge difference. If it works in people the way it has worked in the scientific model so far, I believe it can change healthcare in the 21st century.
Bitton says it will take $2 million to launch a clinical trial. That process will measure both the safety and the efficacy of the drug as it runs the FDA gauntlet. Bitton's team has posted its appeal online at the crowdfunding site Indiegogo.com. Back at the MSU lab, Lisa Lapidus realizes she and Dr. Bitton have a long way to go to raise the money that will put CLR01 in the hands of real human beings willing to give it a try. Until then, she says, MSU can still do meaningful and less expensive work towards cracking the code of degenerative disease.
So we have lots more that we can do simply on the molecular level of understanding which drugs will work and which ones won't. So hopefully that can move forward even if the clinical trials take longer than we'd like.
Dr. Lapidus believes it could take only a matter of months to move the molecule to trial. But then comes the steep climb. There's no one-size-fits-all drug in existence, and learning how the human body handles or rejects new treatment is likely to take many years. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we'll discuss Michigan's new fracking regulations, and we learn about a new prison museum in Jackson. That and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.